right. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you, Jim, for that introduction. I'll mention that I should perhaps just give you a little overview of what I'll be doing these next several lectures. Why don't I just start? My focus is in my work is what's called intelligent design, and I think if you read some of the media, the sense is that this is just warmed over creationism. This is just a new label attached to an old idea. I really think there is something new going on here, because it's possible. I mean, creation speaks about the source of being of the world. God creates, gives rise to the very structure, to the world. Gives existence. Intelligent design is not so much about giving existence to things as taking pre-existing things, looking at arrangements of matter, patterns, and then finding signs of intelligence there. And we do this all the time. I mean, we draw design inferences. It's part of basic human rationality to figure out, did she fall? Was she pushed? Was there an accident there? Or was there something deliberate there? And what intelligent design is doing is saying, we can take this basic human rationality, ramp it up, make it something that is tractable, that is something that we can do analytically, mathematically, statistically, and then start applying it in cosmology, let's say, to fine-tuning problems, or in biology to biological systems, and seeing, are some of these systems really designed? So it's not just an appearance of design. Somebody like Richard Dawkins, a well-known atheistic Darwinist, will say, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. But that's all it is. It's just an appearance of purpose. It's not that there is real purpose there. What we want to say is, no, there are design detection methods, and a lot of my work has been focused on developing such methods, which, when we apply them to biological systems, show that these things are actually designed and not just apparently designed. And so that'll be a running theme throughout the lectures. So tomorrow I'll be doing a chapel service, and there I want to give a sense, a historical overview of just that this is a perennial issue. I think often there's this sense that here we have this Darwinian science, and then we've got these crazy creationists who've just come along with this idea because they find Darwinism threatening. And it's not that it's threatening, it's just that it's wrong, it's false. The science is just not there to support it. Science needs to find explanations that are causally adequate to account for the things that we see in the world. Causally adequate, it means that it can actually do the explanatory work. And the thing is, intelligence has the causal power to create artifacts, to create what we infer to be designed objects. Darwinian mechanism is a trial and error tinkering mechanism. It is very limited in the sorts of things it can do. But if you don't have design, that's all you've got left. Al Plantinga has said, if there is no design, if there is no God, then Darwinism is the only game in town. And so I think that's why there's such fierce opposition, because intelligent design threatens to just open the door. The creation story, everything follows from there. Once your doctrine of creation is in place, there'll be consequences right down the line. It'll ramify into your worldview at every level. So this is challenging really the very foundation. So that's what I want to focus on in the chapel talk tomorrow. Just given a historical overview, because these ideas go way back. I mean, Darwin, this is 150 years ago, but if you read Lucretius, even Empedocles, I mean, this is going back 2,400 years, you're going to find that there are proto-Darwinian theories there, because these are materialists. They're trying to figure out how the world could have formed, how life could have formed, apart from any sort of designing intelligence, teleology, or purposiveness. So I'll talk about that. Then at the lunchtime talk, I'll say a little bit about how I got into all of this. I didn't come into this as as somebody who just thought, I want to do Christian apologetics, and what can I find in the scientific world that I can latch onto that will help give me mileage there. I mean, I certainly did come to this as a Christian and with an interest in apologetics, but I got really going on this as a straight mathematical sort of problem. I was at a conference in 1988 on randomness, and the idea there was or the problem that this conference was trying to address was, how do you come up with a positive theory of randomness? How do you say that something is random? And what you found was, in field after field, that randomness was always a provisional designation. Randomness is not something fundamental. Something is random only so long as you don't see a pattern in it. And once you see a pattern, then suddenly the randomness dissolves and you find that you're dealing with something that's non-random. So, you know, you can look at what looks like a random ink blot, and then somebody points out to you, hey, there's a shape here, and you say, oh, this isn't random, this is design. And once you see the pattern, you'll never unsee it again. The design is not provisional, the randomness is provisional. And so that's really what got me going, looking at the types of patterns that allow you to distinguish randomness from non-randomness, and understanding randomness in relation to design. So design is the more fundamental thing. Randomness is not the more fundamental thing. And that made perfect sense from my Christian perspective, because indeed God is the source of all being. God by wisdom creates the world. We're dealing with a wise, intelligent God who is a designer. So I'll say a little bit about my intellectual odyssey in that 25-minute lunchtime talk. And then the big talk in the evening is sort of my standard shtick on PowerPoint presentation, bells and whistles, going through, you know, why Darwinism is an abject failure. You know, I think maybe this sounds like I'm, you know, inflating the rhetoric, but it is in really bad shape. I mean, and I'm now in the thick of it, engaging with the Darwinists. And I find that the ball is squarely in their court. They're doing a very fancy shuffle trying to get around the problems, but the problems are really biting them, and they're not getting around it. So I'll say something, you know, I'll be addressing that, and then also so showing what the problems are, and then also why intelligent design is the solution. I think, you know, one of the problems is that in science, and I think just generally, it's, you know, if you're just being critical, if you don't have a positive program, I mean, here Darwinism comes along and they're sketching out this world vision of natural history. You know, you can go to natural history museums, you see all these beautiful fossils, and then pick drawings which are connecting all of this. There's a vision of the world that you're given. And then, you know, these creationists come along and say, well, you know, that vision doesn't hold up, the evidence isn't there. But then the question is, well, what's your alternative? You know, and I think Pascal, in one of his writings, was talking about that people come to their worldviews because of what attracts them. It's not fundamentally what, you know, it's not by just some sort of cold logic chopping reason, but, you know, there's an aesthetic dimension to our belief. We try to put it together in a way that makes sense to us. And for a lot of people, I think Darwinism has made the best sense. And I think now the criticisms are piling up, but I think we need to give people an alternative view. And intelligent design, I think, is at least scientifically starting to put that together. So I'll say a little bit about that. And then finally, the talk on Wednesday, I want to talk about what this all means culturally. Where is this going? Because I think there's a revolution which is going to be taking place. And I know the word revolution is overused, but I think there is something big afoot here. And so I'll describe that. So that's the next 2 days in a nutshell. So I don't know if you want to have discussion. Yeah. Well, you know, I was hired at Baylor about 3 years ago to do a center on intelligent design, and that, through a lot of pressure, folded. So I had two titles. One is director of this center. It was called the Michael Polanyi Center, and then an associate research professorship. So basically, that's what I have now. It's I'm paid to do my research, and I'm trying to crank out as much as I possibly can. So I have a home office. That's where I spend really most of my time, and I do a lot of writing. I've got contracts on about 7 books at this point, and so I will get to the one I'm working on with Jim. But you know, there's just I say that in part because there's there's a need to get this work out there. The criticisms, we need to get a critical mass in of to challenge this Darwinian edifice, because it's you know, the money's, I mean, when I consider, for instance, you may have seen a PBS evolution series September, it was right after 9/11, so I think that may have taken away some of the viewership. But there's more money spent on just the video, not to mention the education and propaganda that was associated with it, than I think the intelligent design movement has seen in its 20 years. You know, so we're dealing with, you know, very limited resources, and so the thing I can do is crank out text and get it into circulation and get the ideas into discussion. I think that's what needs to happen. And we're also getting a research community going. We've got a professional society now with intelligent design, ISCID, International Society for Complexity, Information, and Design. And so that's attracting some attention. And, you know, so it's, but I think just getting a research community, you know, it's not that easy. You know, it's, yeah, I think you've got, a lot of, you know, to declare for intelligent design as a scientist, say this is where I want to contribute, you know, as publish in this area. I think it can be a career killer early on. You know, it's just to give you an example. I'm not sure just how coincidental this was, but I have a colleague at University of Cambridge who was for 10 years in a lab with a world-class molecular biologist. This friend of mine, he himself was trained as a chemical engineer at Caltech, but then works now as a molecular biologist. So 10 years he was in that lab. It turned out that a reporter had figured out that he was, in fact, a design theorist. It was reported that day, his supervisor, his principal investigator, told him he could no longer have lab space. You know, so that's, and the thing is, he was just about finishing up really what would be the capstone of 10 years' work, and which would then be, you know, because he was working on this, he was publishing in all the right places, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Journal of Molecular Biology, and so this is going to be the last bit of research to really try to blow open something for intelligent design. You know, so he would have to go to another lab, and apparently the research has all come together, but there's just tremendous opposition to this sort of thing. I mean, the person who did the story on me about Baylor at American Spectator, he was the editor there. He did that, and then a follow-up issue right after that, he was out of that job because.
What, American Spectator?
Yeah, yeah. So if you. Well, and the, you know, it's. So there was, well, the editor was Josh Gilder, and he was a good friend of mine, you know, and it wasn't George. I mean, George was sort of, but George was getting, there were people talking in his ear, and one of the persons who was talking in his ear was somebody who didn't like this direction of critiquing Darwinism. So, and I've just seen this over and over again, where, I mean, the backlash is just fierce. So, yeah. Well, this friend that I mentioned, I mean, I think if it his research, I understand, is now done. He's still at Cambridge. In fact, if this work pans out the way he expects it to, I think it's going to really shake things up big time, because. It's being recorded here, so I think I better not. But thing is, he's looking. He's doing the nuts and bolts sort of molecular biological research with a tractable sort of system. I mean, you know, what has become the mascot of the intelligent design movement is what's called bacterial flagellum. This is a multi-part, complex. You know, requires about 30 or 40 proteins to put together. He's looking at individual proteins and their design properties, so just strings of amino acids. And the thing is, the sort of analysis he can do, if he can show design there, it's much more tractable, because there are a lot, you know, you don't have to exclude as many possibilities, as many Darwinian pathways. And so if I understand it correctly, the thing is, he has, you know, I heard a popular lecture of what he was doing, but if I understand it correctly, I think it's going to show that these sorts of systems are, you can't evolve into them, you can't evolve out of them. You know, when you say can't, you know, the word can, able, you know, capable of, you know, it can be used in a number of ways. I mean, there's sort of logical impossibility. There's no way it can, or statistical improbability. You know, but it's a very strong sort of result. I mean, it's saying that there's no intrinsic capacity for the Darwinian mechanism, which is a trial and error mechanism, to accomplish this sort of thing. You might think of it this way. You know, I'm an amateur chess player, not very good. You know, now given my capacity, there's a possibility that I could beat the reigning world champion 5 games in a row. There's a possibility, and I could just come up with some very lucky moves, you know. But there's no intrinsic capacity that I have to beat the world champion. So if that happened, it would be in spite of my ability, not because of it. And so if some sort of chance mechanism led to these sorts of systems, you know, it would be in spite of the Darwinian mechanism. I mean, basically the Darwinian mechanism was of no consequence in trying to account for this, you know. So that's it's a very strong sort of in principle argument. It's really about as strong as you can make it scientifically, because you're not dealing with mathematical proof, you know. But so that's I think that's the most exciting thing that's on the horizon. And then I think just hammering away, you know, at various aspects. I've got a colleague, Paul Nelson, who's had a manuscript. I mean, this I think gives you another indication of just how difficult it is for us in some cases. Paul Nelson did a doctoral dissertation. He's one of the key players in the intelligent design movement back in 98. He was promised by the editor of an evolutionary monograph series at the University of Chicago. It's not University of Chicago Press. It's a monograph series, very distinguished, to get something in there, that it would be appearing there. Four and a half years later, he's still talking to this person who's still assuring him that it's going to be appearing. But you know, and I'm listening to this because I talk to Paul regularly, and I wonder. I mean, he assures me this guy is, you know, is legitimate. You can count on his word, you know, and perhaps you can. I've heard that. I remember when I was a student at the University of Chicago, that anthropology, it took 11 years on average to get through the program. So some people work very slow. But the thing is, it's just stalled that work. So you know, it should have been out long ago, and so we're waiting for it. But that's some work on developmental biology, showing that the sorts of changes that need to happen in development just do not, that would be needed for evolution to take place, the sort of Darwinian evolution, just don't happen. Because, I mean, if you're going to evolve something, I mean, a metazoan, something which has multi cells, you know, I mean, these organisms start as single cells, and they have to be built up through a process of embryological development. And that the process of development, if there's going to be evolution, that process of development has to change. And yet the sorts of changes that need to take place in embryological development for Darwinian evolution to take place don't occur. So it's a very strong argument. Phil Johnson has been waiting for this work to come out for years, and so it's still stalled. You know, so my preference would be just to, you know, if it were me, I would just have gotten the work out. But it, you know, if it comes out in this evolutionary monograph series, it'll be a huge coup. You know, but you know, so that's something that's in the works. And you know, there's a sequel to Of Pandas and People that's coming out that I'm the academic editor on. John Wells and Michael Behe are coming on board, and it's going to be retitled. You know, I'm not sure what the title is going to be. Maybe something like The Design of Life, but you know, that I think is going to it'll be a much stronger book than Of Pandas and People. I mean, much clearer on the design theoretic implications, and just also dealing with a lot of the current criticisms of intelligent design, and also taking the argument against certain evidences for Darwinian evolution. So those are I think three things that are coming out. Yeah. Mark.
Is there anyone among the Darwinists who is seriously wrestling with its problems?
Well, I mean, there are certainly scientists who are not intelligent design advocates who will yes, who are wrestling with it, saying that this approach is inadequate, and who really don't have an alternative. I can name some names. I mean, certainly within the complex self-organization group, people like Stuart Kaufman will say, natural selection, random variation cannot be the whole story, and he'll give some strong arguments. So there are criticisms. The thing is, the people who are criticizing usually do not, they don't have an alternative. You know, Stuart Kaufman has a book titled At Home in the Universe, the subtitle, The Search for Laws of Self-Organization and Complexity. Now, it's a search. He looks to certain mathematical models which show that, when you run them in simulations computationally, show that certain patterns can emerge when you have certain mathematical parameters in place, let's say. Now bridge that over to actual biology. That's the problem. You can have a lot of things that work just fine in silico on the computer, and that's why I think at Los Alamos now you have an Institute for Complex Adaptive Matter. The emphasis on matter because you don't want it just being computational. So they're putting that over against the Santa Fe Institute, which has tended to deal just with computation. So there are criticisms, but it seems that if you have a dominant theory, and if you can, try to fit as much into it as you can, and then just say, well, we're working on the rest. Give us time, give us patience, give us tax dollars for research funds, That still, it seems, appeals to people more than just taking a critical line and saying, look, this is why it's inadequate, And I remember talking, I had a debate with a fellow named Kenneth Miller, who's a prominent critic of intelligent design and has been of creationism also. This was in the summer. And I cite some of the work of people who say, look, Darwinism just can't hack it. I'll have this quote in one of my slides tomorrow. What is his name? Now I'm blanking on it. It'll come to me in just a moment, I think. But prominent cell biologist, Colorado State University, wrote a book called The Way of the Cell. Franklin Harold is his name. So I cite this, where he says that he dismisses intelligent design, but then in the next sentence says, but we don't have any detailed Darwinian pathways for any significant complex cellular biological system. Okay, so he'll say, and then he adds, only a variety of wishful speculation. So this is Oxford University Press 2001. Now if you've got a theory that's only giving you wishful speculations these complex biological systems, these irreducibly complex systems of Behe, they're pervasive. Our cells couldn't function without them. It turns out, there have been some studies, I think, done recently where most of the, over half the proteins that get used in cells work in conglomerates with about 10 other proteins. So it's not just that you've got these, it's not just that our cells are these bags of floating, proteins out there. Things are working together. There's complex integrated stuff happening all over the place. We're talking about a systemic pervasive problem, which has not been solved by a theory that's supposed to account for how we got all of biological complexity and diversity. Now, something is going on there, and I pointed that out in the debate, and Miller's response was, well, Harold's been retired about 15 years, it was basically as though, well, he's an old guy, he's not really in touch, but he didn't challenge the substance of the criticism, so it's, I think this is probably what we're going to see for a time now where, there's just this glib dismissal ad hominems. Those pepper so much of the criticisms of intelligent design, and then reasserting the theory. I think it's I scratch my head, because I think what's it going to take to get through it? And so I just I'm usually up. I when kids go down, I go to my office and stay up till about, you know, often 1 or 2 in the morning just writing more, because I think the more I can write, the more I can stick it to these people, you know. And that's, you know. So.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate it. Let's express